excited about having a conversation with you this week that I think will inspire you in so many different ways. You know, Feminvest, we are gathering women entrepreneurs, we are gathering women investors under our Nordic community at the moment. And just in a couple of weeks, we're having our largest event in Oslo to date, which is really exciting, where you'll have a founders lounge together with a bunch of really cool entrepreneurs from the whole Nordic region. We'll have some inspiring talks. And one of the talks at the upcoming events is on women's health. And obviously, it's interesting. It's an area that's been neglected for, you know, thousands of years, really. But what has happened in the last 10 years is really intriguing because a whole new industry has been established. And there are quite a few different people across the globe that's been leading and paving the way for this to happen. And today's guest is an innovator in the field. Her name is Theresia Neal, and she's the founder of Gaidea and Femvoid. She's also a femtech angel investor based in the US. And, you know, it's early morning for you when we have this conversation. Are you an early bird? Are you that 5 a.m. club, Theresia?
I am in the 5 a.m. club. I'm not really an early bird, but I have managed to adopt that persona now.
At least today for this interview.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to talk with you today.
Yeah, I'm so excited about all the work that you've done for many years. So, for example, in 2022, you launched something called the Femvate program that has invested over $1 million in femtech innovation. Furthermore, you've been elevating promising femtech startups by giving them some services as a top Fortune 100 company, you know, and it goes from a range of different areas. I want to hear where did you start and how did you move in this direction?
Well, I do have a design agency called Gaidea, and we grew out of Texas in the US. So about almost 20 years ago, I started this design agency. And we're a women-owned, women-led company. We're pretty small, about 20 people. And we've worked with lots of really large companies and organizations in the US and abroad. And about 2 years ago, we had an idea of, well, why don't we give back to women? So very little, as you know, very little VC investment goes to female-founded companies, and very little investment goes to solve specifically women's health problems over in the health side of things. And we thought, well, we can help. So I have this team of fantastic researchers and designers. We have pretty extensive background of designing products in pharma and life sciences and digital health. And we thought, well, you know, we can't fix women's health, right? It's a big topic. There's lots of things that need to be solved. And we're not clinicians, and we don't have an R&D department, but we do know how to design tools for patients, providers, payers, caregivers, and we could donate those services to early stage femtech startups and give them a boost, right? So early stage startups, they can't necessarily go hire the biggest design agencies in the US or the UK, but we have those skills. So we came up with this program called Femivate, where we would basically provide those services pro bono to two or three early stage femtech startups. And once we actually got our first round of applicants, and we had 100 applicants from around the globe in 2022, and we met all these founders, and we realized the need was much greater than two or three teams. And so we invited 30 teams into our program. And then we ran Femivate again last year, and we added an additional 20 teams. So we're supporting, or have supported, 50 early stage femtech startups with their UX research and design.
And what I, you know, from what I've understood and what I've read, it's a wide span. It's like breast health, fertility, hormone health, women's wellness. There's so much to do and so much potential. And according to Femtech Landscape Report, the global femtech market was valued $51 billion in 2021, and the forecast is for it to reach $1 trillion US dollars in the US by 2027. So it's quite a great market to actually tap into. What have you discovered from working with those companies?
Well, I think it's really interesting looking at that kind of explosive growth and trajectory. And it's probably worth noting that femtech is, some people think of it with a really narrow definition of this is like consumer digital products around maybe, you know, period tracking or fertility. But femtech is actually very, very broad. It includes, like you said, uterine health, breast health, anything that's specific to women's physiology, as well as health solutions for conditions that disproportionately affect women. So autoimmune conditions disproportionately affect women. I think 70 or 80% of people with autoimmune conditions are female. What's another one? Dementia disproportionately affects women. And then there's also diseases and conditions that affect women in ways different than they affect men, like cardiology and other conditions. And so femtech actually includes all of that. And it's not just direct to consumer products that we can download from the app store, but it's also the tools that surgeons are going to be using, tools that maybe your GP or gynecologist may use for clinical diagnostic support in the patient room. So it's actually really, really broad. And that was actually the first thing we learned when we started this program. It was femtech is much broader than we anticipated. There's really, I think the way that we have it categorized now is there's really like 18 different sub-verticals under femtech. And then there's a wide variety of product types. So there's digital health, there's diagnostic tools, there's surgical tools, there's software as a medical device. And a lot of these solutions in femtech can be highly regulated. Right. Obviously, if we're creating a tool for a gynecological surgeon, this is something that should have gone through quite a bit of testing to make sure that it's safe before it's used in the operating room. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the things that we've learned, just the sheer breadth of solutions that can fall under femtech.
Mm. I think this is really intriguing. And by working with those companies now for a couple of years, you must have come in to encounter quite a few different trends. Do you have any reflections on trends in women's health in 2024? I read, for example, that, you know, even though overall it was more difficult for companies to raise funds in 2023, what we see is that the median deal size for women's health companies actually went up. This is an article in Forbes for last year. So it is actually, we're seeing some progress and there is a potential there and that we see traction even from the investor side. But what do you see from building the companies?
I'm so excited to see any forward momentum in investment for women's health. I'm glad to have read those numbers as well. I think we're going to continue to see more investment as people become more comfortable talking about women's health. It's just such a taboo topic that people feel awkward discussing some of these conditions. And once we get more comfortable talking about menopause or fertility or aging, or anything specific to breast or uterine health, then all of a sudden it just becomes a healthcare issue, right? And it's a healthcare issue that needs to be solved. And then people can put on, you know, their solution hat, right? And start thinking about, oh, this is a problem that impacts 3 billion women across the world. There's a market opportunity here. Let's figure out how to solve some of these solutions. So I'm excited that people are getting more comfortable talking about women's health because I think we'll see investment follow. Some of the trends that we are expecting to see this year and in the next couple of years are around earlier and easier detection of traditionally late or underdiagnosed conditions. So basically, there's a whole range of conditions that when women come to their providers, or maybe they don't even go and speak to their providers, but they're suffering in silence, or they go to their provider and they're like, hey, I'm experiencing this symptom. And they're dismissed and or told, you know, it's in your head. It's not real pain. It's in your head. You need to relax, or just have a glass of wine, or maybe it's just stress or anxiety. But these are real, actual, physical, medical symptoms. And so there's a lot of products that are going to be coming into the market that will do early detection of conditions. So, for example, endometriosis, it takes on average 8 to 10 years to be diagnosed. We're working with a number of different teams that have a simple at-home blood test that could screen for endometriosis and give results within 2 weeks. So imagine experiencing pain, not really knowing what's going on, going to the doctor, multiple doctors, and being dismissed and ignored for a decade. And instead, you can actually just get a test, or in the future, you'll be able to just get a test shipped to your house, and you can go into the doctor and be like, "Hey, I did this screening. It says it's a high likelihood that I have endometriosis." And that's going to really shorten that cycle
That's
for
amazing.
getting diagnosed.
Yeah. Obviously, I didn't know about this myself, but I've learned in recent years how many women are affected. So this is really a great tool. Exciting to hear about that. If you look at, because I'm also intrigued, because if we look at women's health in the segment of digital health and health in general, what we need to understand that research has to be focused more on women's health. And actually, as we do clinical trials, it has to be focusing on women, and it hasn't been if you look into the history books, which is because it's so important when validating different tools or products or even medicine. But what I also think is interesting to look at is, for example, historically, where have the funding been going to what areas? Because we've obviously seen where commercial products has been launched successfully, that has drawn investors to that segment. So what do we see, like from a health perspective, more generic? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, it looks like a lot of funding has gone into the fertility space because it's a lucrative area. So anything around IVF clinics, early hormone testing, cycle tracking, anything in the fertility space has been, or not anything, but lots of things in the fertility space have been getting investment over the past couple of years. I know that some VCs are reluctant or hesitant to invest in the med tech side of things because it takes so many years to create these medical devices that have to go through clinical trials and all of the regulatory and quality requirements before they're available to the market. But we're hoping to see more interest from VCs and private equity firms in the medical device space because that's where a lot of value can be brought to the global population, is that we could start changing the standard of care for women when they're in a hospital. So one of the teams that we're working with today is called Armor Medical. And they have come up with a proactive detection tool. It's a wearable to detect postpartum hemorrhage in advance. And so this could become a standard of care for women in labor and postpartum so that the nurses and care team would be aware if they are starting to hemorrhage, and that could be addressed beforehand. And so postpartum hemorrhage impacts 14 million women annually. And leads to the death of 800,000 women every year. And their team is working really hard to create a low-cost solution that again can become a standard of care within hospitals and birthing centers around the world.
As European med tech products and also like all sorts of solutions, they often think about going to the US as, being the holy grail of both having a massive market, as US is such a big market, but also the approval would communicate that you are a legitimate business. So that's something that we see a lot of life science and health tech companies focus on. And if we look at your perspective on creating an impact, you've been going from running a business and doing it and focusing on doing it really well to actually seeing an opportunity to change something and bring your skill set to that, contribute to that change with your skill set. What's your advice and thoughts on creating impact?
That's a really good question. I was thinking about that yesterday as well, because I was speaking to a grad student who is very interested in the femtech space. And she's like, what can I do? What can I do that's really meaningful, that'll really help? And so there are quite a few accelerator and incubator programs around the globe for femtech. So there's Tech for ABBA, there's Femtech Labs, there's Station F, there's Health 51. And of course, there's our program, Femovate. And people can donate their time and skills to mentor through any of these programs. What we chose to do, instead of building out an accelerator that provides a wide variety of support for these early stage teams, is we're really hyper-focused on the research and design work, so that when they've completed our program, there's a deliverable. We have actually designed their product and tested it with end users, and it's ready to go into development. So if you're thinking about, well, what could I do to help a company? You could either go, as an individual, you could either go broad and mentor at one of these programs, around the world, and support a bunch of teams with advice that you have as a practitioner in your trade, or you could consider adopting a team. So there are quite a few startups that could use dedicated, let's say, marketing help for 3 weeks, or they could use dedicated copywriting help or dedicated graphic design help or introductions to, an IP legal team or a regulatory team, and maybe put a couple weeks into a specific company to give them a real boost. And that's what we're trying to do. We believe with our sponsorship program that we can actually really accelerate these companies' time to market by giving them dedicated high-end services for a short period of time to kind of get them over a hump. It just basically saves them from having to go out and do an RFP and find a vendor and then assess what company they want to hire and then put together a project plan and then manage that relationship. So they're not only getting our services pro bono, but we should be saving them quite a bit of time in that whole process of finding and selecting a good partner with that healthcare background that's going to support them.
Mm. And what about, because now all of a sudden you get access to all those great ideas. But you also see like how you can problem solve from a design and perspective. What have you learned from this this collaboration?
Oh my gosh, we've learned so much. I've learned quite a bit about the human body. I'm 47. I have 3 kids. I thought I knew about women's health. It turns out I know nothing. I'm much more educated now after working with these amazing founders. But we've also learned that there's opportunities in this space for a lot of these different innovators to potentially pair up. So let's take fertility for an example. In our first year of running Femovate in 2022, we had a team that was able to assess embryos for viability. We had another team that had created a tool to help women as they were undergoing the IVF process. We had another team that was doing early hormone monitoring and tracking, very early on and when people are starting to plan a family. There was another team that was had created a tool for checking sperm viability. All of these are individual tools towards the same end goal. And so when we start working with these companies, we realize there's a platform opportunity of taking these individual innovative ideas, in that case of all, you know, hopefully somebody bringing a baby home. There's a lot of value in pairing those companies up to work together, or looking at it from a platform angle, and thinking about how can we bring solutions to fertility clinics? How can we bring solutions to like a holistic solution to maybe say a couple that's looking to grow their family? So that's been an interesting perspective that we've gained in working with so many teams, that there's really just a lot of opportunity for collaboration, partnership, and looking at things from a platform angle as opposed to an individual like point of care solution.
Makes sense. I see that from a Nordic perspective too, that actually there would be a stronger opportunity to provide multiple services, as they are all intertwined depending on where in life you are. So there's always this hot topic when it comes to especially digital platforms, that's the topic of AI and how it affects the stars of tomorrow, and it is something that is constantly on the move and changing and affecting. What do you see like tomorrow's digital platforms need to consider?
One of the things that I recently read that I found to be really fascinating is that women are 75% more likely than men to adopt to digital health. So for everybody out there creating any type of healthcare solution that's going to be patient or caregiver or consumer focused, it's really important to keep in mind that your primary users and certainly early adopters are going to be women. And so once you put that lens on, it really makes sense to do research, design, and validation, and make sure that's being done with a female audience, right? To make sure that that's going to be really, really well received by those early adopters. As far as tools being either created with AI or powered with AI, or actually having even conversational AI built into the tool, I think the opportunity is almost endless of how this can work. So I think probably the vast majority of the early stage femtech startups we're working with do have AI in some form in their solution. So whether they've created an AI model for scanning and assessing dense breast tissue to look for anomalies or lesions, or they're putting conversational AI as a feature in the patient or consumer tool so that people can talk to it and be like, hey, I'm experiencing these symptoms. What do you think it is? Oh, it could be that. Okay, well, I need pain relief, right? So they're basically having that conversational AI element within, let's say, a patient app for maybe pelvic health pain. The opportunity for generative AI is just absolutely tremendous, right? I think it will absolutely explode over the next couple of years and really transform not just digital health, but healthcare in general, right? People are going to want to be able to get information early on at their computer or from their phone before they even go into a physician's office. And I think it's going to be our responsibility us collectively in technology on the digital health side to make sure that we're getting good information to people before they're making that appointment with their physician. The Planned Parenthood in the US has done a fantastic job with this, with an AI tool they created called Roo, R-O-O, like a baby kangaroo. And it's an AI chat platform for teens to be able to learn about sexual and reproductive health, because teens, and maybe all of us, may feel more comfortable asking those type of questions of a cute chatbot interface than necessarily asking those questions face-to-face with a physician. And so their innovation team came up with this fantastic tool that allows teens to access the information that they need. And they said it's really changed how they're interacting with teens when they show up in the clinics. They're like, they're actually really well versed. They've already gone and found out the vast majority of the information before they show up for an appointment. So that's, I think, a really good example of how AI will, through digital health, will kind of change the whole patient profile, right? Of like, people aren't walking into a physician anymore going, gosh, doctor, I just don't know. Can you help me? To they're fairly empowered and informed before they even book an appointment with a physician.
Yeah, it's like a lot has happened. I was just thinking about, you know, all those like physical like rashes or something similar that you could actually avoid going into a doctor, but actually take a meeting digitally, like how that has transformed our behavior around not always having to go to the doctor for the smaller things. And so it will definitely be a lot of new events happening in the upcoming years where AI will make it faster and improve. So we just have to be very considerate how we store health information, of course, online, so it can't be used in the wrong way. My final question to you would be, you know, from your perspective, and it kind of comes back to why you started investing in women in the first place and in women's health. What do you think happens when women get more money in their hands?
That's a really interesting question as well, because I'm coming from the tech world. So for the past 20 years, we've been designing and validating software for technology companies. So, you know, a lot of the teams that we work with may receive $30 million in a seed round, which is unheard of in femtech, right? Like it would be a huge celebration for a team to receive $30 million in a Series A round. So the numbers are very, very different coming from tech and then moving into femtech and seeing the much smaller investments that female founders are getting. I believe that the femtech founders, not all femtech founders are female, right? We have non-binary and male and female founders in femtech. I think they're all very conscientious of like cost and value. So they are looking for partners that are going to provide very, very high value for the investment, because they don't have tens of millions of dollars at the seed stage to, you know, let's say hire the most expensive or the biggest agency, you know, for development or for design or for manufacturing. So I think these femtech founders know how to stretch a dollar, and really, I think they're very, very disciplined about, you know, prioritizing what they're going to invest in first and making sure that that's going to have the impact that they need to move to that next level. So I guess basically I'm saying if it's a female founder in femtech, they're going to make every single penny stretch to meet their needs, and not waste any of those precious dollars that they're able to actually secure.
Yeah, that is an interesting reflection. And in Sweden, there was conducted a research quite recently in a university in the north, where they looked at different numbers across the businesses managed by women and men, and they saw that there are absolutely no level of, because one of the common you know, arguments for why men continue to get the funding is that women don't take the same risk, and that you don't get the same, it's not the same potential, so to say, translated. And that data actually showing that there is a difference in the potential of investing in women and men. But if you look at, for example, bankruptcies in Sweden, 2/3 of the bankruptcies would be made by men. So actually there's less risk, as you kind of describe as well, because you really want to use that funding, and you kind of grow into that. You don't have that same opportunities from a financial perspective, but you also take more responsibility for each penny. And I think this is so interesting because it shows that there's an upside to it, but it's like a cap downside. Does it make sense?
Yeah, it sounds like that's just another stereotype around or rationalization of why women aren't getting investment, right? You know, they're not going to take the risk, so there's not going to be an upside, or they don't have support, or how are they going to raise a company while they're raising a family? It just sounds like another rationalization of why they're not getting money. I think we all need to look at it from a different lens of we absolutely should be investing equally in male and female founders, mm-hmm. right? There's so many stats around female-led companies being very, very successful. I did hear something last year at the South by Southwest conference in Texas. It was from the Femtech Salon. And this was kind of a cautionary tale I thought was super interesting, though, is that female founders tend to give away, and this is female founders in technology, tend to give away more of their company through equity than male founders do. Because of that, when they do have a successful exit, they're actually bringing in less money proportionally, right? Like, because they've given more away in equity, which puts less money back in the hands of women who would then be investing in the future round of women. So one of the reason that's kind of a cautionary tale is, if you are a female founder out there and growing your company, it's wonderful to be generous, but don't be too generous. Don't give away a lot of equity, right? Maybe use your trusted advisors, or look at the standards that your male counterparts are giving, you know, granting in equity as they're growing the company, and make sure that you're not being overly generous with that. Because not only should you reap the benefit of your exit and still have a lot of equity in your company, that's actually going to, you know, help the next generation of female founders as well, because you're going to have much more money to put back into the ecosystem.
That's definitely right. And that's why we do what we do from Feminvest. We focus on ownership, and we want to educate women on the importance of owning at, you know, different stages. Because I've come across different setups, but I've come across some companies where a couple of guys have started a company and VC has been wanting them to have a woman on board. So they've been giving away like an options program for a third woman to be the co-founder, but with very small ownership. But then I've also been meeting women founders that have been doing an excellent job scaling company for a couple of years' time, but they then get men on board. And this particular woman, she had given away 70% of a company, but she worked up the value of it for 2 years, and then the guys came in and she gave away almost 70%. So she was only owned 30% because she took in some money as well. So the two guys that entered 2 years after she actually had built the company, they got 30% each. So I've seen we need to keep on raising this topic and educating women and men on the importance of ownership. Thank you so much for being in the Feminvest podcast. And we always have an interview with a woman founder as well. So I'm going to leave the conversation over to my colleague Saba, who will interview a founder this week. Thank you so much, Teresa, for a really interesting conversation. And best of luck with your work. Look forward to follow your design work, but also this initiative onwards.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to talk with you.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to a new episode of our Feminvest podcast and a new interview with a new entrepreneur. And it's a very exciting story we have with us today. My guest today is called Malin Bruse, and she's the founder of Grow, which is a company that is shifting the trends towards organic and natural ingredients in baby food. And we know that the global food market is experiencing significant growth, with estimates suggesting a market size of $84 billion in 2024 and a projected value of $137 billion by 2034. We know there is a growing shift towards organic and natural ingredients in baby food, with it where parents are actually prioritizing clean labels and minimal processing. And we have increased awareness about and demand about transparency and traceability in the supply chain. So Malin today is sharing an exciting story about how she started when she had her first kid, and when she noticed that there is a big gap in the market and that the big players are not really working with these new trends that parents are demanding. Welcome, Malin, to this podcast. I'm really happy you're here today joining us with your story and exciting insights about challenges within the food market for babies.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Thank you. So let's just start, like, you know, with talking about more about who you are and what's your background and how, like, share some of, like, you know, some of the starts of your company, Grow.
So my background is as a doctor of naturopathy. I had my own clinic for 10 years. And when I got my first kid, it all kind of changed a bit for me, because I have always been interested, you know, in health and food for my own sake and also for adults. But when you have this small little, you know, child of your own and your first one as well, it's like you're questioning kind of everything. And for me, food was really like a wow experience, because I cooked most of the food myself, for myself. And then when you kind of is ready for solid and look in the baby food shelf in stores, it's like, okay, so it's between dog food and kind of washing powder. And it just didn't feel, for me, it didn't feel as good as when I cooked myself. So most of the food I gave my first child was homemade, but I also had challenges. I mean, of course time, but also like you get so much kind of recommendation from everywhere, like friends, family, you know, health, like practitioners and guidance, and the industry say something and Google say something else. Like, Are you sure you can feed your child of homemade food? Like, is it enough iron in there? And all of those kind of question marks. And I also felt like parents around me had that insecurity when it came to food and children. So I actually started by writing a book, like a hobby, about, you know, like basic knowledge that I felt was missing out there, and also a bunch of recipes. And my father-in-law, he's a doctor and had written books before. So I kind of asked him, what do you think about this? Could it be a book? And he was like, oh, it's super exciting. Can I be part of it? So we actually wrote this book together, and it got published in Norway in 2016. And that was my first kind of attempt to educate parents and support parents when it comes to food and children. And in that period of time, I also took an education within nutrition. And this book sold really bad. So I was like, this is not the solution to kind of spread the knowledge and support that I wanted. So I downgraded my clinic a bit and started to have courses for parents, how to cook your own baby food, and both online and live, and had like traveled a bit and had like speeches and stuff about it, and one of the questions that came, you know, often was like, okay, so now we have learned how to cook our own baby food, but what do you recommend from the stores the day you know, the days where we don't have time or don't have the energy to cook and so on. And that was the first time I really did a deep dive into the food industry, an industry that I had no clue about, really. So that was the start.
That's so interesting. And I think every parent would actually like recognize these challenges that you have when you have a baby started, like, you know, from breastfeeding, going to solid food, or like, you know, trying to introduce different tastes and so on. And we know that you actually grew up in Sweden, but the company, and you moved to Norway before you started the company. So the company is actually Norwegian based, but you're selling.
Yeah, so we started in Norway because I met my Norwegian husband in Stockholm when during study. So yeah, my kids are Norwegian, and I'm not that good in speaking Norwegian, but it's fine.
Yeah.
No, so we started in Norway, and we're well established here. When I did that deep dive into the industry, I was like, it looks good, but the problem is the process. You need to kind of have such a heat treatment. It's four times heavier sterilization on baby food compared to, you know, our own kind of food in, like if you buy, you know, tomatoes or what's the word in English? You know, like in food that stands in room temperature, compared to adult food, it's four times higher heat treatment sterilization. So you kind of kills a lot of, you know, the goodness in the food as well, not only the bacteria, but also flavor, taste, and colors and fibers and all that. So I was like, how hard can it be to just do some really tasty, you know, homemade food in a ready version? It took a lot of time, but it all started, like, I started to share my journey because I had already worked with towards parents with, you know, courses and the book and so on. So I kind of started to share my journey on Facebook and Instagram, and I like started like, this is what I'm gonna do. I don't know how and I don't know when, but let's kind of try it out. So what I did first was actually to do kind of a crowdfunding where you could pre-order the products. Just to kind of try the market and kind of see, is this something people want? And then we sold 5,000 products in 3 weeks. And I'm like, okay, I need to do this. But it wasn't that easy. So I was around in like 8 different countries in Europe to find a producer that was willing to produce the food with only organic ingredients in bites, you know, not purees, not concentrates, and then cold press the products. So we're using a cold press technology to get a longer shelf life in the fridge, like cold press juice. It's also commonly used in like dressings and guacamole and hummus and stuff like that. Pretty new in baby food. You have Once Upon a Farm in the US that has been doing this for a while, but we were then the second company in Europe using this technology. But we are actually the only company in Europe that is only using organic bites of fruit and vegetables, not kind of pre-cooked purees, together with this combination.
That's so interesting, because we know there is a growing shift towards organic and natural ingredients, and specifically in baby food. And we know that parents are prioritizing these clean labels and minimal processing. But still, like all these, we know that, like, you know, all these big players within the industry haven't even been like, you know, looking at this.
No, but that is because the industry has been always steered by kind of big players where the interest is cheap products that are safe. And if you heat treat the product so heavily, I mean, they can't go bad. I mean, seriously, I had one of those, you know, pouches, tried one, and then put on the lid, put it in my shelf, and a year later, I found it again. And I'm like, I wonder if it tastes like, is it bad or is it good? It tasted exactly the same 1 year before. So the food can't go bad, and then it's safe. But it's also like, okay, it's cheap and it's safe, but is it like the best solution? I'm thinking we haven't, I think we should have it all. I mean, it's a perfect product if you're, you know, traveling and don't have a fridge or, you know, can handle fresh food, but it shouldn't be the only option in store. I mean, we adults, we have so much to choose from. And the baby food aisle has looked the same, like, 100 years back. So yeah, it's definitely time for some innovation, but it's also a quite conservative industry to innovate. So everything we do pretty much is new and innovate. I mean, we even have a taste guarantee on our products. Have you ever heard that about baby food?
No. You told me about it lately when we met actually at the Fearless in Gothenburg, and I was like, okay, that's interesting. It's lovely. Yeah.
So we have a fresh product. It tastes really good. I mean, it's even good for parents or older kids, but we focus on the youngest because their nutrition is the most important thing. It's also about like nutrition, yes, but it's also about a taste experience, right? So yeah. But the first challenge was to find a producer. The second challenge was to kind of find people that knew how to do this, because I didn't. I just knew that I wanted to do it. So finding the right people and build a team was also a challenge, because in the beginning I was like, you want to work with me? You know, so happy that I wasn't alone, pretty much. So,
And when was that? I mean, from going from the idea of launching this kind of product and launching the crowdfunding campaign that you launched to actually have the product ready and to deliver to the customers. How long did it take for you?
2.5 years before I started the company until we had a ready product. So those pre-orders, they had their second child before they got the product.
but they were patient enough.
They were so supportive and so happy. So very grateful for that. I joined Antler, the first cohort in Stockholm, actually, got my kind of business education there for 9 weeks. And Antler was also our first investor. And then we got an introduction to Orkla. That was our second investor. So we had kind of good support from the beginning. And it's also not only to kind of create this great product, but you also needed capital. So, I mean, you can't just, so you have your own, like baby food has its own regulations. So you're not allowed to just, you know, standing at home, cook and sell. So you need to work with professional producers, professional, you know, logistic, warehouse, everything. And then you have minimum order quantities to kind of, and at the same time build a demand. So I think that is also the reason why many doesn't really dare to enter this industry, because it's so capital heavy, especially in the beginning, to kind of get it up and fly, because you're working with, you can't grow organic as easy as if it would be food for adults.
Yeah, but you made it in Norway, and you're entering the Swedish market as well.
Yeah, so I mean, now we have been live for a bit more than 3 years. Finally, we are earning money. Now we don't have to take in money all the time, which is a relief.
Amazing.
So we have fridges in the baby food aisle in around 90 stores in Norway, and around 110 stores in the dairy section. And then we also launched now this summer our first snacking product, raw bars. And they are ambient, so they are easier to handle. So then we got another 1,000 stores in Norway. And this last fall, we also got our first central listing in Sweden. So that was a win, because we started in Sweden a bit too early, before anyone knew about us. And we got a listing at Mathem, and it was like the online retailers in Sweden. And no one kind of knew what it was. No one saw us. We didn't sell anything. So after like 9 months, we were like, we agreed that, okay, let's end this and come back when we had kind of built a brand, because building a brand takes time. And especially in this category, you really need to build that trust towards parents, because you're selling a product that kind of you're feeding your most precious, you know.
Definitely.
So and for us, it's also super important to have that tight connection with parents. So we have been kind of communicated and sharing very openly and transparent everything we do with our parents. And they are also involved, like when we do product development, what they want, what they don't want, what they think is important. We're asking them regularly to kind of get support. And they have also, because we are sharing so much, parents has also helped us selling into stores, because they can always ask, like, we want this product. And then the stores are going back to their, you know, central office, and they can kind of, then it's easier for us to also negotiate and kind of get better listings. So we have really been, I would say that without kind of our parents, as we call them, we would never have succeeded like we have done.
Yeah, that's lovely.
So but now how... we're yeah, doing the same in Sweden, but it takes a bit of time to kind of build that trust.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and working on the branding of the company itself here in Sweden. How about, like, I mean, the challenge of maintaining affordable products while using high quality ingredients within this kind of market and industry? How do you tackle that challenge?
So, I mean, we are a premium brand. And that is because everything we do costs more. We have high quality ingredients. We're using a technology that is more expensive. We have chilled distribution and warehousing, which is more expensive than ambient. And so our products, they are more expensive also for customers. So for customers to kind of value that, we also need to communicate this super, super kind of detailed and educate. So that's actually a challenge, because we need to communicate together with, like, we're selling products, but we're also kind of selling a communication package to kind of educate people about production, because there's not very, like, people in general don't understand food production, and that is because no one is talking about it. So we
and you assume that the big players have all, like, you know, all the information and all the important stuff already taken in consideration. But, like, given what we are experiencing when it comes to, like, clean food, we know that this is not the case, really, and we're not getting all the nutrients.
We don't get all the information.
Yeah.
I mean, the big players, they have this cooking, you know, stew in the kitchen, and then you have the ready products. I mean, there's a lot of steps in between, and it's not very pretty. So, I mean, it's like we need to educate. We are showing videos from production, how we are mixing, how we are filling, how we are cold pressing, and how we, and kind of educating. But it's also a bit challenging, because we're showing how we are doing things. But if you don't kind of know how others are doing it, it's hard to compare as well. So, and we don't want to talk bad about other producer. We would like we are focusing on how we do things differently. But of course, but that's also like why we say you need to taste our products, because okay, you don't necessarily understand, you know, food production, but you do understand the difference between good taste and bad taste. You do understand the difference between kind of fibers and texture and no texture. So that's why we are a lot of out and sampling and trying and tasting, because you need to taste to really understand what we're doing.
And you're actually educating parents also by, like, being available
a lot.
Would you do the book again in a different version now? I mean, given your experience.
I mean I have definitely thought about it, and I mean now it's 8 years since that got I think 2024. Yeah, I mean, it's still relevant, but I would definitely do some updates on the book today after learning a lot more. I have thought about it, but I don't really have time. It takes a lot of time to write a book.
Totally fine when you're focusing on Grow.
yeah, right now it is like that, but we have talked about it as well. Like a grow book, because we that's also part of what makes us a bit different. Like, we recommend the parents to cook their own food, and we even have recipes on our products how you can cook them at home, because we truly believe that when you do your own food, it's such a great experience, not only about the food but also kind of the routine and kids to kind of see and, you know, experience the whole thing. And we want to be the best option when you don't cook.
Of course, yeah. And we know that convenience is a major factor anyway, influencing like consumer choices, leading us to like, you know, higher demand of ready to eat, but still like nutrient food for the babies, of course. But given what you have achieved so far and you're like, you know, your plans for the future, how does it look for the next year and 5 years for you and Grow?
In Norway now we have starting to become a bit more known brand, so we definitely want to utilize the next years here we're working with product development all the time. Now this year, we will launch powder porridge in Sweden and Norway, and we already have ideas for future product development as well. So Sweden and Norway will have the biggest focus now the next year. We are looking at Denmark or Finland for the next market, but we haven't decided yet. So we need to do a bit more research and kind of see how that would be executed. Scandinavia, we're definitely focused on the next coming years. And we see that going out in Europe, we will need to get support from a bigger player somehow. Like that. That's the learning really from going from Norway to Sweden, that it's quite demanding, definitely financial demanding, but also kind of resources in general. So that's a big learning for us. When you're kind of growing in your first market and moving too fast to the next, you need resources, and we went to Sweden a bit too early because I'm from Sweden, but we have been able to kind of balance it out.
I'm really happy that you are present in Sweden, and I know I'm confident that you will be able to kind of like, you know, have your presence and your brand out in the market quite soon, actually. And I encourage every parent to actually check out Grow. It's a great way to provide the baby healthy, nutritious food and like at least try it if you have this taste guarantee.
Exactly.
Yeah. And you can find it also on grow.no. Is there a .se also?
Yeah, it is. The fresh products you need to buy either in Stockholm, Sweden, or we can also sell that through the web shop, or else the raw bars, they are in stores in Sweden and in Norway. Yeah.
Lovely. Malin, we have been talking a lot about how you started, how you decided and how you came up with this idea and how you made sure that you would be able to accomplish what you were trying to achieve with regards to the food industry. And we have had so many takeaways regarding your challenges, how you started and how you made it possible in Norway. So I'm sure that this will be the case for Sweden as well. And we have had talked about the food industry and its dynamic market with significant growth potential, understanding the consumer preferences for organic and fresh food, but also like, you know, the convenience about having ready to go food for their babies that is well nutrient. And we know that companies like yours that prioritize quality, transparency, and cater to this kind of specific need from the parents will be well positioned in the market in this evolving landscape. So I'm really happy that you were sharing all these insights with us today. I'm hoping that we will follow your journey and we will have more talks later on at the end of the year, probably, and hear more about the Swedish market and how it developed. Thank you for being here today.
Yeah, I hope I have inspired others to enter this industry, because we need more players that has the focus on food quality and taste.
I love that. Thank you so much for today, and happy listening to all of our listeners.